Good evening. I'm Walton Hetherington, host of The Colonial Report, the first cable news show in America. Well, Christmas is coming, 1776 is coming to a close, and let's be honest. If we're going to win our freedom from England, America needs a new general in charge. That's the subject of tonight's Talking Points Dispatch. George Washington is washed up. He opened the year with a brilliant success at Boston, and too many of us bought into the idea of Washington as savior. I was one of them. It was a gutsy call, of course, marching thousands of men and several massive cannons up the Dorchester Heights in the cloak of darkness. Oh, to see the looks on the redcoats' faces when they woke up the next morning, our big guns staring down at them from on high. But Washington blundered in the months that have followed. He decided to invest just about everything in defending New York, but the British always held the water. General Howe's ships easily paraded up and down the East and Hudson rivers as if they owned the place. At some point, you would think Washington would know that there was no way to save New York, and to dig in was to be slaughtered. Even worse, he bumbled when retreating to the north, trying to save Fort Lee. It was a dreadful decision, frankly marked by indecision. He couldn't even make the final call. He kept deferring to others who had more direct experience. What a loser. That was the moment when we should have known that George Washington was finished as the leader of this cause. And now comes word that his own closest advisor, Joseph Reed, is writing letters to urge General Lee to usurp power from Washington. Not even Washington's closest ally believes in him anymore. Everyone can see the truth. George Washington is an inexperienced buffoon, fumbling in the dark, unable to inspire confidence in even his best friends. I have come to fear that George Washington is, and I choose this word carefully, a traitor to the American cause. I worry he is secretly a loyalist, an anti-American plant. At the very least, he must be out by the end of 1776 if we are to have any hope of independence. That's our dispatch. Let me turn now to Wexford Benningford, political analyst for the Colonial Report. Where am I going wrong, Wexford?
I wish I could say you're wrong, Wilton, but we have no time for patience. You cannot learn on this job. It's past time to dismiss General Washington in favor of someone with more expertise and judgment.
Well, are you certain, though, that we're not being rash? I mean, there's this part of me that worries that cable news, this new invention, is pushing us to condemn any mistake as fatal and to not allow for human beings to be human?
Nonsense. Cable news is exactly what the colonies need right now. It allows us to reach almost every household to make absolutely fair, thoughtful conclusions, not at all tied to filling airtime and attracting advertising dollars.
We are making our country, our hopeful country, better, aren't we?
My goodness, yes. And we will be saving our country if we can pressure Congress to send General Washington home. Let him do what he does best. Work on his estate, build a fireplace, tend his garden.
And he would be lucky to avoid a trial.
Indeed. And at the very least, I can comfortably say that if Congress allows General Washington to remain on the job, there will be no United Colonies of America, no independence. And thank goodness we invented cable news just in time to render such wise evaluations.
Well, last question, and then we'll have to leave it there. Whom might you choose to replace General Washington?
I would start with a man of great conviction, of great valor, someone who leads with confidence and clarity.
And that is?
Why, Mr. Benedict Arnold.
Ah, brilliant. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we take a closer look at the Hessians. Those are real soldiers under real leadership. Stay with us. Okay, that's our imagining of what cable news might have sounded like in 1776. Kind of a simultaneously fun and troubling exercise, isn't it? But let's shift now to an earnest discussion about how George Washington was not a deity, just a man, and a man who was able to turn around the course of the war 240 years ago this week after what was, and you heard a lot of what you heard there was sort of accurate, a bad year of 1776, that led up to those decisions at Trenton and Princeton. My guests include Dr. Michael Leroy Oberg, who's a distinguished professor of history at SUNY Geneseo. Dr. Oberg, great to have you back here. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Dr. David McGregor is here. He's a professor of history and international studies at St. John Fisher College. Dr. McGregor, nice to have you as well.
Nice to be here.
Okay, apart from terrible accents and terrible acting, there was at least a sense in the beginning of the year at Boston in 1776 that things were turning in the Americans' direction. But otherwise, Dr. Oberg, it was not a good year for Washington and the American cause that year, was it?
It wasn't. The Continental Army, which was formed in 1775 by Congress, had taken a beating over the course of 1776 in terms of Washington had retreated constantly from Manhattan to Brooklyn, back to Manhattan, across New Jersey, and finally across the Delaware the other way, less famous way, running into Pennsylvania. And, he had, by default, sort of mastered the art of retreating, which is an art in and of itself, right? It's easy to throw down our guns and run away, but to run at the same speed to the same place under the same leadership, that's a skill. And the army was on the ropes. By the winter, Washington, or the beginning of the winter, Washington was in Pennsylvania wondering what to do next. And generally, the pattern had been for armies to sort of hunker down for the winter and not engage in campaigning. Washington did feel a time pressure coming on. In the middle of December in 1776, Thomas Paine wrote, I think arguably the greatest pamphlet of the Revolution, The American Crisis. These are the times that try men's souls. It was read in Camp Washington we're not trying to deify Washington, with some extraordinary leadership, managed to persuade these men to stay on past their enlistments, to launch one final campaign against these scattered British garrisons sort of spread hither and thither around New Jersey, culminating the attack on the Hessians on December 25th, the night of 25th and 26th, and then the subsequent attacks at Trenton and Princeton.
All right, we'll get there in a second there. Dr. McGregor, how would you characterize Washington's performance in 1776? Would you have been with the analysts calling for him to be out?
Well, actually, in autumn of 1776, I'd be calling for Admiral Benedict Arnold to take command of the whole show, because he's the only guy that had actually done something right in the last half of 1776. He stopped the British from coming down from Canada, as they tried again to do the following year. But they were coming down from Canada in 76, and Washington would have had to worry about being attacked from the north and the south. Except Benedict Arnold managed to stop them on Lake Champlain. So Benedict Arnold is actually the winner in the going into the winter of 1776. As far as Americans go.
And Dr. McGregor, I have, it's dangerous how little reading I've done. I've read just enough to be excited about the history, but not nearly to the scholarship of you and Dr. Oberg. But I do.
We're still excited.
I do read about the decision to go from Boston to New York, and I'm puzzled, because when you look at the geography that he was dealing with, if you don't control the water, I mean, this was not a secret. I mean, I don't know if it was Nathaniel Greene or others who were sort of saying, look, if we don't control the sea, it's going to be hard to sort of build enough fortifications to win. We don't have a force this size. Was that a mistake to begin with, to think? And I think he was hearing from John Adams in Congress as well, anything that you need to hold New York. But was that a mistake to begin with there?
Well, New York's a very valuable asset. You can't give it up without a fight. It's where the money is. It's where a large part of the population is then. The British, I think, had some reason to think if they took New York, everything would fall apart. Mm-hmm. And from the point of view of Washington and others, you don't want everything to fall apart, so you can't let it fall apart without a fight. It turns out to be not very much of a fight in New York, but to just not try at all, I think, would have been politically a strategically bad idea.
Well, and Dr. Oberg, I think, points out that when you become known for your retreating skills, eventually you want to let the men serving you at the time know that you can actually win battles. Though his escape from Brooklyn was masterful. I mean, he did, that was a retreat. For all of the shots that Washington took leading up to the end of 1776, I think it's important to point out that had he not executed that retreat and maybe got a little assist with morning fog, there might not have been an army to retreat with, right?
No, and I think there's a lot of that. And with New York, right, some of these decisions that Washington are making are forced in by the British, right? The British started off thinking that the revolution really had a center. That center was in Boston. They occupied Boston when with the getting the artillery up on Dorchester Heights and all that made Boston untenable. Then the British sort of embarked on a kind of traditional military operation of maneuver and conquer, right? If you defeat the Continental Army, you win the war. And Washington was dealing with that reality. And as long as the army existed, the revolution was still alive. So that retreating was critical. But I think that the Howe brothers and, you know, who were all speaking with, you know, two men speaking with two different voices. One is more of a peacemaker who's hoping to talk through a settlement. You've got generals who are too cautious. You've got generals who, like Cornwallis, who are too aggressive. I don't see a unified British strategy, and a coherent British strategy. You've got the Howe brothers sort of hunkering down for the winter in New York City, which is probably your best bet if you're going to spend a winter in the American colonies, spend your time there. But you got these garrisons there, and they were ripe for the picking. And so what you do see are these really brilliant, creative attacks, the first one crossing the Delaware on Christmas night to attack this Hessian garrison, taking 1,000 prisoners, losing a tiny number of men, really, given the standards of time, is immensely successful. And again, the idea is he retreated back across the river to Pennsylvania, and then he went at it again, right? And this attack on Trenton on the second, right?
Princeton?
Yeah, no, Trenton first.
Oh,
yeah.
Trenton.
Crossing
yeah.
over to Trenton and fighting off this, setting up this defensive location at Assunpink Creek, right? And the second Trenton, driving off Cornwallis's troop, but knowing after that attack that he can't hold it, right? That when morning came the next time around, he was toast. Not a military term at the time, but it was bad, right? It was going to be bad. So instead of crossing back to Pennsylvania, which is probably what everyone expected him to do this end run, this 18-mile march on frozen ground at night in silence to outflank the British forces, Cornwallis' superior force, and hit this smaller force at Princeton is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, and you know, from what I've read at the time, you know, when the British would capture, as they did, especially in New York and Brooklyn, when they would capture American soldiers, they were often amazed at how poorly dressed and how many American soldiers didn't have shoes. I mean, it was written at the time that you could follow the trail of the army by looking for the blood in the snow from American soldiers who had no shoes, wrapped their feet in rags, and were bleeding as they walked. You know, they marched as a group. Is that hyperbole? I think that's not hyperbole necessarily, is it?
You read those accounts. I'm not sure how exaggerated they are or not. The one thing I would say is that the notion that the Continental Army was a ragtag group of amateur soldiers who didn't know what they were doing is just patently false.
Okay.
They were not rookies anymore.
They might not have been well-dressed, but they were pretty
well prepared. And you got the constant rotation of troops. You got militias coming and going. Right? Militias like the sand in the wheels. The sand in the gears of the British effort to pacify the countryside. But you got all these things rotating out of the camp. But that was business as usual. This was an army that learned, that was exceptionally well led, and of course Congress was then as now, right? Seldom able to get the money where it needed to be. Seldom able to get the provisions where they needed to be. Was factionalized and divided along state lines by all kinds of petty jealousies. Even with all these constraints, it was an effective army. The Revolution War is twice the length of the Civil War, twice the length of World War II. That Washington kept this army together with these constraints we all hear about, these lack of provisions, these lack of resources, is a testament to some extraordinary leadership and some extraordinarily talented command and control in the army.
Well, let me ask both of you. So when you talk about extraordinary leadership, after the mistakes that Washington had made in 1776, then he had those amazing successes at Trenton and Princeton. And we'll get into that in a little bit more detail coming up here. But is it not a sign of leadership to be able to internalize the mistakes you've made and to effectively learn pretty well from them, as it appears Washington did, as opposed to being insolent about, well, General Lee is a little bit obstreperous and my first assistant seems to be stepping out of it. You know, I mean, he might have been wounded emotionally by that, but he didn't seek retribution against those who didn't have confidence in him. He seemed to learn from that. And is that Is that fair to say, you think, Dr. Oberg?
I think that is fair to say, and I think it's also a matter of understanding the type of war he's leading. There is no United States, right? It's an idea, right? And it's going to require, the simple fact is it required military force, organized violence, to transform the Declaration of Independence into something meaningful, right? Without organized violence, that declaration would have meant nothing. You have to keep this army alive. You have to keep this army together. Sometimes that means getting along with people who don't like you and dealing with criticism. And I think Washington, to his credit, understood what the game was and what the goals were. Keep this army in the field. Drag the war out as long as you can. Fully aware of what's going on in English politics with the, you know, it's 1777. There was a offer to settle. By that point, it was too far gone, long since too far gone to settle. But he understood that the British couldn't afford to fight a prolonged war.
Mm-hmm. Dr. McGregor, what do you make of Washington's decisions then at Trenton and Princeton? Had he not decided to cross the river and go after the Hessians, this is sort of the ultimate what if, and maybe a little too shallow because it's impossible to know. But is it possible or even likely that the war would not have gone in the Americans' favor?
Well, I think the revolutionary effort was in serious danger of falling apart if he hadn't done something brilliant over the winter of 76-77. If the ending game of 76 is, well, we lost New York and we're about to lose Philadelphia, and we didn't lose Philadelphia in Christmas of 76 basically because William Howe didn't want it yet.
Right.
I think the discontent and the divisions between America and Britain by even Christmas of 76 were so vast that if the war is stopped, it's going to start up again.
Okay.
So, I don't think that we become Canada after that and we're a happy British Commonwealth for the next 200 years. No. But I think the revolution gets a lot longer, a lot bloodier, a lot harder if Washington doesn't do something clever in 76.
Now, Dr. Oberg mentioned the sort of the steady flow of reinforcements and this historical idea that it was all just a ragtag, kind of a sort of barely literate amateur army is not a fair one, as the British discovered, I think, at Trenton and Princeton. And I think that's where Cornwallis and others took it a lot more seriously after that and were forced to. But having said that, you did have enlistments running out, right? I mean,
right.
So you say that Washington needed to sort of turn around the morale and the feeling of desertion, or do we take this British offer, more Americans becoming loyalists and trying to protect themselves. He had to try to stem that tide. And did he have to do it before January 1 or essentially early January? Because with the enlistments running out, these men may not stay. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely right.
Yeah. The end of the year.
They could fight in militia. They could stay close to home, not leave their state boundaries, which was a more palatable form of service than continental service. So they absolutely had to do something that year. And I think, for anyone listening, if you haven't read Tom Paine's Crisis, just read that first paragraph, and I think you can get a sense of just how inspiring words on a page could be when read to the camp and read to the soldiers. Washington had it read in camp, and others, generals, had it read in other parts of the colonies as well. So look, he persuaded these guys to stick it out. He promised with a bounty of, $10? Congress will pay it. Don't worry about it.
That's a lot of money at the time.
Yeah, it was.
If only it were real.
Right. It was paid. Yeah, right. We can get into that one. But it's the promise worked, and the promise got these guys to stick around, and these attacks were significant. Now, as to whether the war would have, had this not succeeded, we would have lost the war, it's hard to say. There were plenty of opportunities down the road for the British, and Washington had plenty of defeats, including some bad ones in 77, later on in 1777, and so on. But what you do, I think, see coming out of this campaign is that the British stuck it out in New Jersey, and not only do they face this Continental Army, but you have this constant raiding by militia troops, and to defeat the militia was difficult. They weren't great it's stand-up fighting, and you could smack them and they'd run away, but then they'd reform, and it was like nailing jelly to the wall to try to knock these guys out. And they would, you know, there was a militia commander, Philemon Dickinson of New Jersey, one of the famous militia commanders. He had his own crossing of the Delaware in early 1777 and captured a British foraging party. This militia was, you know, and the British want to go and crush this, they got to march through the countryside. They've got to, and that meant imposing upon the local populace and stealing their chickens and their pigs and rummaging through their land. And what this British presence did was alienate the local population. And that coupled with a militia that would go door to door and make you choose. And that's the thing that's really, I think, the incredible story on the revolution. One thing that makes this revolution a revolution is that everyone had to choose. At some point, are you going to sign the Continental Association or not? Are you going to join your? Are you going to show up for the militia muster or not? Are you with us or are you?
What's the consequence of saying I'm a loyalist?
Well, they could be bad. I mean, it varied from neighborhood to neighborhood. But if you were in a divided Civil War area, it could be rough. Your property could be destroyed. It could be physical violence. The consequences could ruin your life. And ultimately, I think you see the British just sort of say, okay, we can't do this. Let's go to the South. And they by 1778, they're working in the South trying to go there on the grounds that you've got a friendly, active Tory loyalist population. That didn't work out either. But sort of trying to deal with this problem caused by the army. And look, the British took every city. There was no geographic center. There was nothing that you couldn't put a stake through the heart of this movement and kill it. And so as long as Washington's out there moving, as long as these militia movements are moving, there's nothing you can do about it.
So even if Howe had not sort of dithered on Philadelphia and decided, I'm going to go forward to Philadelphia, you're saying that hard to kill, had they gone through at the end of 76 and said, we'll take Philadelphia now, as Congress feared, Congress had fled Philadelphia, if I'd read correctly, had Howe done that, you still think the movement would have been this amorphous, hard-to-kill thing?
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, they did take Philadelphia the following year, and that didn't win the war. They pulled out again after the winter was over.
And Congress was always on the move, right? Congress was always on the run, and I think that shows it, that there was no capital, right? There was nothing where you could say, we've occupied the American states and we've got it. There were dozens of them. They couldn't control the interior of New Jersey. There was guerrilla warfare for the following 6 years in New Jersey. There was nothing they could do.
Isn't it actually helpful to have Congress on the run, scattered? You know? Yeah, sure. Chase them out of there. Yeah. Chase them out of York now. Keep them
busy. Question from modern times. Look at the parallel. Tom emails the program and says, Evan, great fun with this, but please explain for your listeners who the Hessians are. Okay. We mentioned the Hessians. That's a good question. Who are the Hessians, Dr. McGregor?
German mercenary soldiers. Some of them are from Hesse. Some of them are from other German principalities. But they're all German soldiers, trained, experienced veteran soldiers with lots of military experience that are hired by the British to fill out the army that they don't have enough British soldiers to man. So key thing is they're mercenaries. They embarrass the British. You have British parliamentarians like Edmund Burke saying, you know, we don't want to win a war with hired Germans doing our fighting for us. So they're controversial in America especially, but also in Britain. But they're vital manpower for the British to have because they don't have enough of their own.
And 240 years ago, you had the Hessians with the British and the Americans hoping to eventually convince the French or others to send some forces. And that's why I think, you know, it's fair to ask if Trenton and Princeton at least helped accelerate some of the willingness to get some help in this war that came, you know, in the months that followed. But the Hessians, if you read some of the letters that survived, some American soldiers viewed them as pretty scary, you know, really imposing fighters, particularly when it got to bayonet fighting.
Yeah.
They were, at least they had a reputation among some as pretty ferocious.
Yeah. No, they were, and they were ferocious to the civilian population that they were working in also. They were, now everybody looted in 18th century, mm-hmm. but the Hessians were kind of very proficient and very enthusiastic looters, even by 18th century standards.
So. Yeah, a lot of them, though, were young men far from home doing work that no one else wanted to do that was offered them when British decided on a military solution to a constitutional problem. And a significant number of those Hessians stayed in the newly independent United States. And
is that right?
Yeah, and others immigrated afterwards. Yeah. So there was this sense that I think once we scratch off that layer of propaganda, that many of these Hessians were probably no better or no worse than a lot of other soldiers.
Sure. Yeah. No. Of course. Absolutely. And speaking of sort of the propaganda, let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back and try to at least address a question. You know, if you read certain histories, they say that, well, the Americans won Trenton because all the Hessians were drunk from the night before at Christmas partying. And then you hear others saying there's no evidence of that that's just another slur against the Hessians. But what happened to allow Trenton to happen? I mean, George Washington crossing the Delaware, we've probably seen the painting, but he had tried to design an attack from several different angles, and you had some of his leadership decide that the weather was terrible, it was too dicey to cross, but others did go through with it. So we'll talk about Trenton and Princeton and more with our guest, Dr. Michael Leroy Oberg, a distinguished professor of history at SUNY Geneseo, and Dr. David McGregor, professor of history and international studies at St. John Fisher College, when we come back. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. You've heard the term microaggressions before, but do you know what the definition is? And do you think they are real? Some people say they don't think there's such things as microaggressions, but we're going to hear about it from the reporters and the staff of Open Mic Rochester. We'll talk about that and their recent work in our first hour. Then second hour, geeks, nerds, is it their moment? Seriously, talk to you Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about what happened 240 years ago this week, the extraordinary end of 1776 and the beginning of 1777 that certainly increased the American enthusiasm for the Revolutionary War effort. And some historians, perhaps to sell a few books, but some think that really turned the tide in the war itself. But it was a big series of events that really turned a bad year for George Washington and his army into a very different feeling as the war progressed into 1777. And our guests are talking about some of what happened and the significance thereof. Now, I just want to talk a little bit about crossing the Delaware. I mean, if you've seen the paintings, it is memorialized with these, you know, gallant images. But the reality, I think, was that it really was terrible weather that Christmas night, and that Washington's plan was at least cast a little bit awry by the fact that the southern branch of the attack, they thought, we can't get across this river. It's there's too much ice. The weather's awful. It's not going to work. But they did get most of the force across, even if it took a little bit longer. And even that alone, Dr. McGregor, had to be a serious undertaking, getting all of those men and equipment across an icy river in horrendous sort of sleet snow weather.
Well, remember, George Washington's army has a secret weapon, those Marblehead guys that got his troops across out of Brooklyn. before it's they're still with him. So he's got good boatmen in his army able to get across the Delaware. And in that sense, his amphibious capabilities are one of his secret weapons that the British would have thought they would be the experts at. So you have to give credit for, in some ways, an amateur army is good because you have unexpected skill sets in people that have real jobs before and after the war, and those real jobs turn out to be really handy in getting across bodies of water. So,
and they were able to do it. It took a little bit longer, but they had to do it at least with some degree of acceleration, Dr. McGregor, because like Dorchester Heights and like the escape from Brooklyn, the idea is you've got to be where you need to be by the time the sun comes up, under cover of darkness. And they were a little bit late, but they at least got the bulk of the forces in position to attack Trenton the next morning when, you know, ostensibly the Hessians may be sleeping off Christmas, etc. This idea that they were all drunk soldiers, though, is a little bit of a slur, unfair, isn't it?
Well, it's a the post-holiday day, so it's not peak efficiency. But no, they're not all falling out of their beds, not knowing which end of their musket to fire. No, they're still soldiers, but yeah, it was an opportune time to attack. I would say, as opposed to a week later.
You know? And is it also fair to say that Washington's, I think, the brilliant nature of this attack was coupled with the fact that Howe was very confident that he could bunker down for the winter, that we wouldn't have to campaign, that we could sort of pause for a while, that Washington has been humiliated, they're on the run, and that It may not be post-Christmas alcohol. It may be just this idea that they're across the river. They're not coming for us. And that may be the brilliant nature of this attack is, you know, you're catching them at a time where they think that you probably cannot even muster an attack, right?
Yeah. No, the whole point of Howe's strategy at the end of December is let the American army melt away. Don't create a politically motivating massacre that's going to make people angry. Mm-hmm. Just let nature take its course. And the outposts along the Delaware are supposed to just be watching the fun. They're not expecting anything to happen back at them. If they had expected anything to happen back at them, well, Howe would have had his army in New Jersey. It's definitely a case that they expect nothing aggressive to happen ever again from the Americans. And then they get a surprise.
They wake up on the morning after Christmas and cannons are going off and soldiers are there. It became a pretty quick battle. Dr. Oberg mentioned about 1,000 prisoners taken, very few Americans dying or injured, a number of Hessians killed in the battle there, some of it with cannon and musket fires, bayonet fire, some of it bayoneting in the streets. It got very rough there. But Dr. Oberg, I'm reading this going, how do you even take 1,000 prisoners? I mean, that's an amazing feat in and of itself for a small army.
Crossing the Delaware both ways was work, and crossing with men under guard was work too. Speaking of alcohol, right, there were stories that the American troops were celebrating on the way back, and they were falling out of boats. You know, that could have just been the dangers of crossing in rough weather or stuff like that. I don't know what's going on. But, yeah, no, there's the logistics of this are really incredible.
Yes.
I think the reason the Hessians were surprised. They had little choice but to surrender in this attack after some fighting. But the logistics of getting back across the river were incredible. And you know, the other thing about it is they managed to get these guys across, get them in position, get, 18 cannons, something like that, 18 number of artillery pieces across.
That would still fire in the snow,
right?
Yeah, and keep it secret. Washington knew where he had a map, right? The map's at the Library of Congress of where everything was in Princeton. He knew where the artillery emplacements the British had were there. He knew everything. They had this information, the spies. Washington managed. He put sentinels on the at the crossings well before anything got there to keep anyone from saying anything. But they managed to do this in secret. I think is impressive as well.
Yeah, I think about modern times. You know, the other day I was driving and I thought it's a little cold in my car. I just want to. It's 70. I want it 72. And I had just finished reading about, you know, the battles of Trenton, Princeton, and the awful weather. And I thought, boy, what would Washington say today if he could even see that? Just a different time. But as Dr. Oberg points out, you know, you can take Trenton, you can capture the Hessians, but Cornwallis is not far away.
No.
And you know you can't hang out there forever. And so I thought Dr. Oberg made a great point in that you can't keep fighting them off, and Washington instead sends, well, kind of a flanking maneuver. What kind of happened to Princeton?
He crossed back to Trenton and held off an attack by Cornwallis, but he knew that Cornwallis knew that there was a maneuver where Washington's flank was vulnerable. So he's essentially got two choices, or a couple of choices. One is to stand there and fight, which he knew he couldn't win because there were reinforcements going to be coming up from Princeton. He could retreat back across the river, or he taking advantage of some extremely cold weather, colder than on Christmas, where the ground froze and allowed the wagons to move more easily. They moved south and then, or they moved east and then north around Cornwallis's force, leaving some men behind to keep fires burning in the camp to make it look like they're still there. They had these men sort of digging away with picks and shovels to make it sound like they're
work's going on.
Yeah, working on the fortifications.
Yep.
And they're going around. And the funny thing is that they could easily have missed the bulk of the British troops coming from Princeton to Trenton. Washington was coming up one road. British were coming under Lieutenant Colonel Mahood, I think, were coming down another road. And Washington sent this guy, Hugh Mercer, to go destroy some bridges along the path to slow any potential British movement towards Trenton. And it was Mercer that ran into Mahood. Mercer got into a fight probably by 8 in the morning, was fighting with Mahood. Mercer was his men were beaten and broken. Mercer was ordered to surrender, refused, and was bayoneted to death. story, whether it's apocryphal or not, is that some British thought they'd killed Washington. And Washington sort of came up and rallied these troops. And this is another one of these great things about Washington, at least these myths about Washington. When he was rallying these troops, he was, what, 40 yards? It's a distance from home plate to second base from British lines. And he had this uncanny ability not to get killed. in standing in the midst of fire.
Do you think this part of the story, that he's riding through the orchard after Mercer has been bayoneted, rallying the troops, almost essentially in the line of fire, is that apocryphal, or do you think that there's enough to believe that he did that?
I think there's enough to believe that.
Wow.
Oh, there's multiple sources.
Yeah, there were guys written accounts of guys who close their eyes figuring, when they hear the volley go off, figuring that he's going to get dropped. And he's still there. So those accounts are quite common. And, you know, in Washington, throughout his career, it had sort of this reputation for luck.
Looking
bullet holes
around.
In his clothes and horses getting shot. He had this odd kind of pear-shaped body, which is good for falling off horses and not getting hurt. And he was very, you know, he had this myth about him at the time too. It's not just historians who made that up, or Parson Weems who made that up, or Washington Irving. It was at the time he was seen as a special guy, and he had enormous influence with his men.
And this becomes even though Mercer dies and Mercer's men were kind of overtaken, when Washington arrives, they kind of turn that battle right. I mean, it becomes a success, right, Dr. McGregor?
Right. Yeah, no, it absolutely, and the British end up retreating instead of Washington. I mean, it's now neither side holds Princeton for the rest of the year. Washington goes into winter quarters, and so do the British. But Princeton and Trenton together do get the British to essentially write off southern New Jersey, and it's American after that. So I guess Washington gets credit for taking back territory, even though both armies stopped fighting after Princeton.
Yeah, and look at it this way, right? Washington was outnumbered by Cornwallis. So one of these ideas is, yes, keep the army in the field, keep retreating, but fight when you have a chance. And when he attacked at Princeton, he outnumbered the British forces that were remaining there, right? So use your force smart, use your force wisely, attack in those instances where you're capable of amassing more force than your enemy. It was an incredibly risky maneuver to get those guys around 18 miles. 18 miles in 21 degrees is what one of the accounts was. 18 miles in 21 degrees in that kind of clothing and that, you know, I can't even let the dogs out in that kind of weather, right? You know, and it's just
and a lot of these guys have barely eaten anything.
And it's just an extraordinary thing. So fight when you can, and I think that's where Washington really proved an incredibly adept leader. But keep in mind, he's being aided all the time by this constant militia harassment of British troops and British outposts, and that involved, you know, killing a lone British soldier or firing on people, just hassling them with fire and all kinds of just military interference that you really couldn't do anything about because they won't stand and fight. They snipe at you and they run away.
Well, we're talking about the battle we're talking about happened 240 years ago, 2 days ago, January 3rd. And now I think that orchard where that happened, where General Mercer died, I think that's Mercer County. I think they named it after General Mercer there, if I have that correct. But let me also ask our guests about sort of Washington's legacy beyond that. Obviously, he goes on, ends up becoming the first American president, and his farewell address, he talks about the problems of political parties and partisanship, which nobody apparently listened to at all. But Dr. McGregor, there's a lot that I think could be said about George Washington's legacy in terms of where he was brilliant, where he was great, where he had failed, where he had learned from his mistakes. I look at that moment, and after Princeton, for example, there were articles written in American papers saying that if idol worship was happening, they would build statues to the man, even at the moment. And he had regained after that terrible 1776. He gets these victories. There's all this enthusiasm. They're talking about building statues and worshiping him at the time. And years later, becomes the first American president. Could he have done what a Fidel Castro or others have done once they gain power, where they don't want to relinquish power? Could he have decided forget terms. I'll be president until my death, and then Martha's children would be great to follow me. I mean, could that have happened with Washington? I find it remarkable that he was able to then, after all of that, say, my time's up, and this system of governance is going to require transitions of power and not, you know, a monarchy. We're not going to become that.
Well, I think this is well after the war now, of course. This is in his giving up his the presidency. I think the man has a genuine sense of duty. Now, Washington had a lot of personal ambition. He liked adulation. He liked, you know, success. He's not just some small farmer. But he does have a sense of duty and the sense of he doesn't want to create a monarchy. Now, his family, he doesn't have his own children anyway, so it's not like he's got a family line to create. But he doesn't want to make America a monarchy. He genuinely believes in what he fought for. He's a serious man, and he's not going to, for personal gain, screw up the cause that he fought for. The man is admirable in his devotion to what he fought for. It's kind of hard in the 21st century to think of political figures as being perhaps that sincere.
Well, sure, because men, and it's usually men, sometimes women, but throughout history, men have not a very good track record of relinquishing power when they could otherwise seek to keep it, right?
Yeah. Though I do think it's fair to say that Washington, Washington could have screwed up his adulation. If he had tried to become a king, there would have been plenty of people that would have said, that's not the George Washington we thought we knew. Yeah. Faction would have.
He might not have been popular enough to say, you know, let's keep me here for a while. Okay.
Yeah, he could have gotten a third term, but he couldn't have created a dynasty, I don't think, had he wanted to.
Okay.
Perfect example of this is in 1783 at Newburgh, New York, where the army was encamped. Essentially, after the fighting had ended, and, you know, Washington is in charge of an army that's sort of demobilizing to some extent, and there were rumors going around the camp that Congress would not be able to pay the officers their guaranteed pay, and there were rumors circulating that perhaps the army should take up arms to procure the benefits that they had coming to them. Historians disagree over what was happening at Newburgh, whether there was a coup d'etat being planned by junior officers, whether this was the propaganda a propaganda campaign by Alexander Hamilton and some of his allies to try to coerce Congress into getting off the pot to allocate some money for the army. But whatever the case would be, Washington as commander-in-chief has faced these rumors that the army should involve itself in civilian government. And he, you know, and there's a number of accounts of this. He engaged the officers. He called a meeting, or he walked in on a meeting of these officers. According to the classic account of this, he began to speak, and at some point in his speech, he kind of paused, and he seemed at a loss, and he pulled some glasses out of his pocket, something no one had ever seen him do before, and he said, "Gentlemen, I've not only grown old in the service of my country, but I've grown blind as well." And according to the account, now everyone, the officers, broke down weeping, abandoned their plans, and decided to do the right thing. But what I think the lesson of Newburgh is that Washington very early affirmed the principle that the military in this country does not get involved in civilian politics, that there is a divide. Right, and I think had Newburgh not happened in the way it did, and had Washington not undertaken this action, it's very likely that this country could have fallen a pattern like some of the other revolutions that were contemporary with it, like in the South American republics, where military involvement was and remains to some extent routine in the politics of those countries. So I think Newburgh is sort of the perfect point to illustrate what David's arguing here, is that Washington had probably had the opportunity to seize more power than he ended up with. And he was sort of the obvious choice for the first president because he was the one truly national figure. Had he wanted more power, he probably could have taken it, but he was committed to the idea of a republic, and in a republic, the military does not get involved in civilian politics.
How many examples like that throughout history? I mean, look, we all have our fields of study, and this is, but it's hard to think of too many examples where again, usually men, gain power and say, you know, this is enough. You know, not a good track record throughout history. That's why I find maybe most admirable about Washington. Is that fair, Dr. Ober?
I think you know, the American Cincinnatus is what he's called, yeah. The Roman general who retired and was called back to civilian office. And you know, the idea that Americans embraced nonpartisanship even while they were slandering each other in public politics through the early republic. But the idea was that the president was supposed to be above party, right? So if we wanted Evan, you to be president, you would say, "Well, no, only if the people call upon me. Only then can I accept the call." The idea that you would say "I" or pursue ambition was just anathema across the early republic. You know, Washington was a unique individual. And the other thing is, had he taken a third term, he would have died in office. Yes. Mm-hmm. And that could have opened a kettle of fish. God knows the transition from Adams to Jefferson was messy enough as it was, where you may have had troops marching on the Capitol if certain Pennsylvania politicians are believed. You know, I think there was a lot of good fortune attached to some of the decisions that he made.
Dr. McGregor, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I've been trying to think, because my real thing actually is British rather than American history. You noted a certain sympathy to the British point of view in some of these things. And I'm thinking, who in British politics, given the fact that it got a monarchy, but who in British politics outside the royal family could have had a lot more power than he actually accepted? And I'd offer the Duke of Wellington. I think the Duke of Wellington, coming out of the Napoleonic Wars, was kind of like their, you know, magical George Washington figure. And he could have perhaps dominated British politics more than he did as just leader of one party. Mm-hmm. So he also had Washington's sense of sincerity and didn't really want personal glory as much as he wanted his country. So give Wellington the Washington crown in Britain, maybe.
It is too bad that Martha decided to burn the letters, that that we don't have a lot of the personal correspondence from George Washington. And I think one of the great pleasures I have in reading, you know, history, reading biographies, is the amazing amount of correspondence that was saved from many historical figures. And they wrote so beautifully. You know, we don't write this way anymore. Even just, you know, letters from Washington to General Lee and Washington to Reed and Washington to Adams, they're just written with such tremendous prose, and maybe it was common for the time.
Among his level of society.
Yeah, sure. But I wonder what we've lost with missing correspondence. And I wonder, Dr. Oberg, just when it's 100, 240 years from now, when this studio is filled by, you know, the next generations of hosts and they're discussing, the leadership of 2016 and others here, what's the correspondence? Are they going to be looking back with sort of shame on the level of correspondence? Are we going to be digging up Twitter? Or is this just the medium of the time? I mean, there was no Twitter and email, and we don't really write letters anymore. Should we be sad about that?
I couldn't predict what was going to happen in the election, so I'm not going to predict what's going to happen in 240 years or any point down the road. But what I think, you know, one of the things I would tell the listeners out there is that much of Washington's paper has been digitized. So not only can you read the transcripts, you can actually read it in his own hand online at the Library of Congress website. Mount Vernon's website has a bunch of the stuff. And Washington's not alone, right? This internet thing is going to be huge. and so much of this the correspondence of the founders and even lesser figures of that era has been digitized, and it's available to anyone. It's this great democratizing aspect of historical research, so we can all go read this stuff. And I agree with you, the writing is there's an art to the writing that we don't have. George Washington never tweeted, you know, and you know, he conjugated verbs and didn't use emoticons and things like that. He spelled everything out, and that generation did. And letters were burned, letters were destroyed, letters were miscarried, but a lot survived, an immense amount survived. And from that, you can get a sense of the temperament of the person. And it's not just the letters, right? It's we were talking about this before we came on, the pension applications, right? There's if you were an old man and you wanted your pension for serving in the Continental Army, you went before a board in the 1820s, 1830s, and these old men came before these boards and they told their stories, and their stories are written down. And these stories are most of them are they're preserved in the archives, but they've also been published. Many of them, they're fantastic stories of what life was like at the soldier's eye level. An account of Washington coming in and breaking up a fight between two soldiers. And you know, again, David and I were talking about this. Washington was the kind of guy, when he got angry, he wanted to make it count. And essentially, Washington was big. He's big for his time, grabbing these two guys and kind of knocking their heads together and swearing like we can't swear now. yeah. and so there's just so much, you know, people say that the revolutionary is remote. It's not. There's so much material that's so easily available to anyone who wants to go read it.
Well, I appreciate what both of you have brought to this hour, and the more I read on it, the more I want to read more. The more I want to see their words in their own hands. There are times where I read, for example, Nathaniel Green, I read, how can anybody read that handwriting? But again, it was a different time, and I understand that. Yeah. I'm just thrilled to be able to see it, though, in their own hand. And that's a great way to end the hour, because our education shouldn't end in a classroom. You know, classes, whether it's in middle school, high school, college levels, only have so much time. So thank you so much, Dr. Michael Leroy Oberg, who's a distinguished history professor at SUNY Geneseo. Great having you, Dr. Oberg. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And Dr. David McGregor, history professor in international studies at St. John Fisher College. Great having you as well, sir.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Megan Mack. Our thanks to Tim Shea for volunteering his voice for the 1776 version of the O'Reilly Factor. And to Catch Wars, the engineer today. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon. We'll talk to you Friday.